We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network podcast. My name is Khadija Amelda, and I'll be your host for the day. I'm here to interview Professor Shafiq Karimkurayil on his 2024 monograph, The Gulf Migrant Archives in Kerala, Reading Borders and Belonging. He is Associate Professor at Manipal Center for Humanities, a constituent unit of Manipal Academy of Higher Education, India. His book is the first ever study that explores the Gulf Migrant Archives in Malayalam, which is a language spoken in the South Indian state of Kerala through photographs, films, and literature. It combines textual analysis with anthropological and historical details, along with providing a historical review of migrant literature and film in Malayalam. An inquiry into the various dimensions of the Gulf in Kerala as an acknowledged means of living, as a rumor, an object of gossip, a public secret, or even a private thrill, this book debunks the idea of language as a common entity. Without further delay, let me welcome Dr. Shafiq Karimkurayil on board. Thank you, Shafiq, for joining me today. Many congratulations on the monograph. I enjoyed reading it a lot. Whenever someone says we are from Kerala, people often jokingly say, oh, you must have an uncle who is in the Gulf, which is true for the majority. This book goes beyond the popular narrative of Gulf migration, be it the narrative of hardship or the narrative of forgetting the roots after migration. How would you like to introduce the Gulf Migrant Archives in Kerala to our listeners? And how much of your experience of living in the region has influenced the making of this book?
Yeah, hello. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for having me here. So to answer your question, I would describe the book as an effort to understand the momentous transformation that the Gulf effected in Kerala. Now, I don't want to reduce it to a question. I did not want to reduce it to a question of economy or of individual social mobility. So one thing I have wanted to do through the book was to capture the Gulf as it got translated in Kerala, because because it's a circular migration, you are not allowed citizenship in the Gulf. So people come back and they'll go back to Gulf, come back after every 2 years, 1 year, etc. So actually, almost everyone in Kerala is a potential migrant. So there is a translation which happens of the Gulf to this public sphere or to this sphere in Kerala. Now, this translation happened in songs as early as the 1970s. It happened in stories and novels, films and photographs. But also, and this is important, it also happened in rumors and gossips and tall tales. So what I wanted to do is that I wanted to capture the Gulf and Gulf migration in this dimension. In these translations, the Gulf was a space of hardship and labor, of course, but it was also, and this is important, it was also a space of wonder and magic, a space of treasure and good fortune, a space of exaggeration. This dimension of the Gulf was not yet captured in the studies on migration. But one does not really understand the phenomenon of migration without discussing this particular dimension of the Gulf, this dimension of exaggeration, of wonder, magic, etc. Now, the problem often was that we did not really have an established language for speaking about this. The economic and demographic discourse is so strong that when we speak about migration, even cultural aspects are discussed as social remittance, cultural remittance, etc. The discourse of economy is all about remittance. So I wanted to capture some of that wonder and exaggeration and irrationality that the Gulf was. and to some extent it still is in Kerala. Now, to answer your second question, I grew up partly in the Gulf and partly in Kerala. And this perhaps influenced my sensibility. I have had the opportunity to see the Gulf as it was seen in Kerala in those years, in the late 1980s and early 1990s. But in those days, when if you wanted to see the Gulf, the only way to see it was through photographs. And if you look at my book, I have like my own photograph on its cover. And it showed that early 90s Abu Dhabi, like, you know, I mean, so different from what it is today. So in those days, the Gulf was then subject to all kinds of fantastic imagination. All kinds of things could be imagined about the Gulf. Like it was a place where people travel in planes like we do in the buses, like, you know, hanging by the rods and stuff. Or like, you know, you have this figure of the Arab who is at the same time very cruel, but also very benevolent. Rich in wealth, but, you know, so poor in natural wealth. Like he comes to Kerala and he is thinking, oh, why do you even come to the Gulf? You are so blessed by God and all of that. In fact, you know, it's said that one of the reasons our place is called Kerala comes from Khairullah. That, you know, these Arabs would call it like, you know, okay, this place is God's own country. It is the, you know, magnificence or of God. So, you know, why do we even come to the Gulf? But in my time in the Gulf, I could also see, because I would go to Abu Dhabi very often, this difficult conditions of living in the cities where all these bachelors, I mean, they are not really bachelors, they are just called bachelors because they don't have their wives there. So where these bachelors were crammed into rooms, and I have stayed in these rooms on a few occasions, so I mean, 8 people in a room, all these bunk beds. But at the same time, I also want to say that I was privileged enough to live with my parents in the Gulf in much better living conditions. So I could see these stark disjunctures between the locations like Kerala, city life in the Gulf, you know, or life in the desert in the Gulf. And this, perhaps this gave me some view into how these disjunctures got translated across space.
Thank you for that introduction. In today's India, Kerala is often in the news for its model of development or even resistance to the current political regime. You bring the Gulf as a lived experience while encountering the progressive politics associated with Kerala. Can you describe more about the lived experience of the Gulf in light of the critical take on Kerala's progressive politics?
Kerala has a history of progressive politics and has also achieved quite a lot in terms of creating conditions for social justice. So therefore, the books, I mean, you are right in saying that the book has a very critical take on this. But I also want to say that it is a very tempered critical take. And I'm actually building on existing scholarship here, which is that by the 1960s, the revolutionary communist politics of the 1940s had given way to governmental politics. And matters of livelihood, instead of being a public concern, became a labor and trade concern. Now, what I wanted to say in the book, what I wanted to add to this, is that this governmental turn in the 60s, it is important to understand migration. Because essentially, what happened was that labor, livelihood, when it became a concern of labor and trade, it became a private concern in Kerala, in Kerala's public sphere. And one could be citizen in the public sphere without ever referring back to this private domain. So basically, the Kerala society developed cultural modalities to act out the citizenship in terms of, like, you know, basically citizenship became a matter of cultural taste rather than questions of livelihood or labor. So basically, the lesson here is that Kerala therefore missed the chance to revolutionize private life. And features like caste stayed on, in essence, in Kerala's private domain. One place where you could see this is perhaps these matrimonial columns in newspapers. Here, so basically, when I say caste, it includes Islam and Christianity, because, you know, I mean, Muslims and Christians are in substantial numbers in Kerala, which has its own caste, perhaps, you know, discriminations within it. But more importantly, in Kerala, when we refer to Muslims and Christians, they are often understood to be another caste rather than another religion. Like, one of the things that we notice is that even interreligious marriages in Kerala are often referred to as inter-caste marriages. And so it's a very telling thing about, you know, how social configuration happened in Kerala. So, to come back to the question. So, with this caste surviving in the private domain and the public domain becoming essentially, once you reduce it to a cultural taste, it becomes a domain of performance of citizenship. So, essentially, basically, the public sphere in Kerala is a domain of mimicry. And migration was the way in which the lower classes of the society could also take part in this mimicry through consumerism. Now, precisely because of this dichotomy between public sphere and private sphere, because of this kind of gap between public sphere and private sphere, the ways of speaking about the Gulf could never take a public form in Kerala. And that is actually at the heart of my book.
That's an interesting response. So my next question has two parts. The first one is on the cultural approach to migration. It is a new take as the majority of the existing studies on the Gulf migration are on the political economy side associated with it. So how easy or difficult was it to do a cultural approach to migration?
So the cultural part is important precisely because of this reason. Because, you know, the public sphere in Kerala is essentially a cultural. So when I started studying this, what was easy about it is that whatever I wanted to study, like, you know, my primary details, photographs, stories, literary works, they were all around me. So I had grown up hearing many of these stories, like, you know, I mean, many of these rumors, gossips, all these tall tales about the cult. And migrant photographs are easily, like, you know, the most abundant thing that you see all around you, those photographs from the 80s and 90s. Now, the difficulty in studying the cultural aspect was that, see, there's a worn out way of speaking about migration. In this particular manner of speaking about migration, and we are all very familiar with it, migration is so much about, you know, alienation, identity crisis, rootlessness. So all of this particular discourse of speaking about the migration, it pushes the migrant into perpetual victimhood. Now, I wanted to see the migrant who could imagine these photographs, who can present new dressing sense, new sartorial sense to Kerala, new shopping experience to Kerala, new architectural aesthetic to Kerala. So I wanted to see a migrant in my book. I wanted to see a migrant who's capable of telling these tall stories about an unknown land. And, you know, this migrant was making a world around them. I wanted to present a migrant who thought of his life as an adventure into this unknown, and whose toils, of course, built Kerala and the Gulf, and who could imagine and aspire for their land to be equal to the lands that they migrated to. Basically, we are constructing a Gulf in Kerala, and who thought of their children as citizens of the world equal to the children of the first world that they had migrated to. So basically, that migrant was missing in not just academic productions or journalistic reports, but even in the migrant memoirs. And this is because of this worn-out language of perpetual victimhood. So clearly, it was the absence of a language in print rather than a reflection of the available discourse which existed in other forms. Because if you look at photographs, that is not the kind of migrant that you get there. If you look at the songs, that's not the kind of migrant that you get there. So, essentially, this language of the print was a land-based ideology. In this land-based, territorial-based ideology, traveling was thought of as the destiny of the hapless. Only poor people, unfortunate people travel. But such a language could not recreate the collective imaginations of a past in which one's ancestors were imagined to be travelers. Like, you know, I mean, look at our histories. All communities have histories of having come from elsewhere. Or basically, I mean, look at all those exhortations to travel, like, you know, you go and seek knowledge from faraway land or build relations in faraway land or just, you know, travel to simply see the world. There are all these exhortations in our culture. But the language of our print was so terrestrial, was so, you know, sedentary. So, and this sedentary point of view is something that we have to change. So, of course, I do not claim that I have welded a new language. I mean, that, of course, needs much more creativity than I do. But I have tried to stretch this old language in newer directions.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it covered in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
As a follow-up to the previous question on the cultural approaches to migration, what were the ways of doing it in your book? And if you build a cultural archive, how intrusive can it be to the people belonging to the lower classes of migration?
Okay, so this is a very pertinent question, because if you look at most of the people who are writing about migrant experiences in the world, they all happen to be white-collar workers who are usually writing on blue-collar workers. So if you look at, not all of them, some of them write on about white-collar workers themselves. So if you look at, for example, Muzaffar Ahmad. Muzaffar Ahmad is a journalist. Benjamin, author of Cortes, he is an engineer. Khadija Mumtaz is a doctor. Babu Bharadwaj was a journalist and an engineer. Krishna Das worked in a bank. So all of these are white-collar workers. Now, it is important to look at their work because they shed light on what was life, you know, on most days for most migrants in the Gulf. So, I mean, there's a particular realism in their work. There is sexism, there is racism, there is abuse and exploitation. But we also see solidarity, laughter, camaraderie, all of that is there in their work. But these are all basically stories which came out in the 2000s. They started writing in the late 90s. Babu Bharadwaj was the trendsetter. Even though he was writing over the 70s, he's still writing it in the late 90s. 98, 99, and then it comes out as a book only in the 2000s, right? But of course, there was Gulf even before that, right? I mean, people had been migrating in big numbers from the late 1960s, and Gulf existed mostly as images in the Gulf photographs or in these rumors and gossips. Now, if you look at photographs, they were not by white-collar workers. I mean, they were also by white-collar workers, but that is not the case generally. I mean, these photographs, you see photographs taken by office boys, construction laborers, cooks, drivers. So, and I look at these photographs in the book, and they're fascinating because, you know, there you see another world. You see basically the intermediality between photographs and world cinema, for example. So these photographs, actually, what do? They redefine the status of migrant worker. So migrant worker is not just a material laborer. He's also an intellectual labor, imaginative labor. Because if you see, even in the early 1980s, these migrant laborers, when they imagine the Gulf, and in those days you see photographs of what Gulf used to be, it's mostly some few small buildings and desert all around. But even in the early 1980s, these migrant laborers could imagine the Gulf as if it was some location in the US or in Europe. Because, you know, I mean, their reference point is this cinema. So basically, even when the Gulf states started moving towards tourism only in the late 90s, Dubai Shopping Festival, I think it was started in 1997. But the migrant laborers in the Gulf could imagine the Gulf as a tourist location even in the early 1980s. So that is the kind of redefinition that these archives alert us to.
It's indeed important to bring in such distinctions. Going ahead with the next question, the formation of an intimate private sphere is a key theme in the text. The toils, sweats, dreams, and desires of the migrant are a part of this private sphere. It could take the form of a rumor or revelation. Why did you go ahead with something like the formation of a private sphere instead of the always spoken Kerala public sphere?
To clarify, it's not really about private sphere as a private space. I am actually more concerned in the book about genres of speech. And I am basically speaking about the private genre of speech. So there is a very important reason to this. And it actually goes back a long way to my childhood. So when I was a child, people would write letters, of course, as you would know. And these letters, they come in bulk. One envelope will have many letters. Some of them are intimate letters, so they are read privately. But some of them are not so intimate letters. Now, the not so intimate letters are usually read out aloud with the household sitting. I mean, you would perhaps know this. Everyone would be sitting around and there'll be this one person who is reading out aloud. So I remember listening to some of these letters in which these migrants would clearly be describing the kind of hardship that they have in the world. Okay, so perhaps not all of it is said, but a lot of it was said. So basically, we knew, the household knew that things are very difficult. So similarly, when I started studying migration as a researcher in the last few years, I have come across many people who have lost their dear ones in the country due to many reasons. So, and some of these reasons are not so good. So basically, the idea of the Gulf as a place of hardship, it's nothing new, at least in the families which had migrants. And they were, of course, by the late 1980s, there were hundreds of thousands of people, of Keralans in the Gulf, right? But when, and this is the curious thing, when Ardjividam, which was translated as goat case into English, when it came out, what was the discussion in the public sphere? The discussion in the public sphere was that here is a novel which has finally exposed the real living conditions in the Gulf. Now, given that we always knew that life in the Gulf was hard, what does it actually tell us? It, for me, what it meant was that, you know, so far, even though we knew the hardship of the Gulf, it was known as a private fact. Basically, we knew it through letters, we knew it through telephone calls, or, you know, even someone like Sagir, who had this comic strip in which the migrant says, even though it doesn't show the Gulf at all, you get to see the letters from the Gulf in which the migrant says that, you know, things are so difficult here. But what it means is that the life of hardship in the Gulf never got the kind of consecration that print literature offers. And that is what actually was getting celebrated with the release of Goat Case. Because essentially everyone knew that life in the Gulf was difficult. So basically what Benjamin did was to give a publicly legible form to the hardship in the Gulf. Basically through a novel which is both like a reportage, but also in first person. Because if you look at the novel, it has a frame. The frame says that, you know, all of this was heard from this guy Najib, who's a real guy. I'm just, you know, I'm not even adding anything to the story. I'm not fluffing it up. I'm not sugarcoating it. It is exactly as he told me. But if the novel after the frame, like within the frame, it is completely first person. So basically, what does the novel do? The novel combines first person with reportage. And basically, this gives that intimate feeling, but also it is a novel. It is print literature. It has got that stamp of public sphere on it. So once I understood this, a lot of things make sense. Like, you know, why did we have so many stories of exaggeration about the Gulf? Why did we have so many tall tales about the Gulf? Why did we have all the stories of people who travel in aeroplanes as if they are buses? All of this is basically, I mean, they basically told me that it is actually about a private genre of speaking. That, you know, what was important in understanding Gulf was also to understand this distinction between private genre of speaking and private public genre of speaking. And also, once you know this, it also explains the grip of the Gulf fantasy, because actually Gulf works in Kerala as a public secret. Everyone spoke about it, but all the time they spoke about it as if it is a private affair. So this, unfortunately, the public ways of speaking about it until Benjamin was of economics and demographics. And that was the sad part.
Thank you for sharing this observation with us. One of the interesting factors of the text is the relationship between everyday technology and migration in Kerala formed out of the Gulf migration. One example you write is Kattupattu, the cassette recorded songs in the letter formats. Can you talk about Kattupattu?
Literally, Kattupattu means letter songs. Kattu, letter, pattu, song. This is, as a genre, has been in existence at least from since the late 19th century. You see, I mean, there are letter songs about migration, about Hajj pilgrimage, or, you know, going to faraway, like, you know, places within India, but other places. But when the Gulf migration happened by the late 1960s, it was huge. So this became a new area for these songs. So the trendsetter song in this letter song genre came out in 1977. It was written by Sayyid Abdul Jameel, also known as S.A. Jameel, very simply. He has this song called Dubai Kattupattu. So it came out in 1977. The song is as if it is written by the left behind wife to the husband who is in the Gulf. So, see, all these songs are like this. Basically, it's like mimicking the letters written between the wives and the husbands. The husband is in the Gulf and the wife is in Kerala. So, it's, of course, then it is a solo song. Like, you know, I mean, it's not a duet. You know, it's either completely male voice or completely female voice. There is a very formulaic way of writing letters in those days. To my respected husband from the loving, you know, there's a particular first two, three sentences are formulaic. All the letters will have the same kind of. Even the applications that we give to village officers, for example, still has that same format, if you know. So this song, basically, they mimic that entire formula of letters. And basically, it's like a letter in a song. Now, so there'll be a letter and there'll be a response to the letter. So it's not, it's all a song, but it comes in this couple format. Now, after a few years when telephones became a little more widely used, we have a new genre, which is this telephone song, which comes out of the same. But basically here they are duets because, you know, in a telephone, you have two people speaking to each other. So again, you have this wife and you have this husband. But actually, one of the known songs in that telephone format is, very surprisingly, by a woman who is in the Gulf and her husband who is in Kerala, which is very interesting. So, yeah.
Now, I would like to discuss the visual culture side of the study. You speak of two shifts within the Malayalam cinema history in relation to the Gulf migration. The first one is from the 20th century, where the protagonist is a Gulf migrant who has made easy money from the Gulf. The second set of films released in the 21st century portrayed the hardships and struggles of migrations. Can you delineate between these two sets of films?
The Gulf rarely appeared in Malayalam cinema until the early 2000s. Like, you know, I mean, there was a film which was shot partly in the Gulf in 1980, but after that, there's this long gap. But at the same time, references to the Gulf were there throughout the 1980s and 1990s Malayalam cinema. Basically, the idea was that Gulf can give you unimaginable riches. So even when it showed hardship, for example, in that 1980 film, initially there's a lot of joblessness around. But essentially, what is the story? The story is about this guy becoming super rich, overcoming all the detriments, right? Now, in the late 90s, we have a change in discourse. So, films started speaking of the Gulf as a place of loss. So, I have especially two films in mind here. One is the 1998 film, Kallikondru Penna, basically, which translates to A Woman of Stone. And then there was this 1999 film, Gershom, which is named after the biblical character whose name means stranger, son of Moses. So, I mean, these films suggested a shift, and there's a string of films which followed in that line. Now, these days, I mean, that time is also over, basically. These days, if you look at it, there are a lot of Malayalam cinema. There's a lot of Malayalam cinema which is shot partly in the Gulf. And even though there are many of these films are specifically about the Gulf, there is no overarching theme. Like, you know, there are different kinds of themes. For example, it can be about the sheer opulence of Dubai. It can be about labor and sexual exploitation. Or it can be about the idiosyncrasies of this judicial system in the Arab states. Like, you know, but there is no overarching theme. We have all kinds of different kinds of themes today, but it has become much more common to have films shot in the Gulf than it was previously. Yeah.
Thank you for that detailed response. You also speak of a counter-cultural movement to the mainstream cinema through home cinema. Home cinemas were produced and shot in the Gulf and were sent back to Kerala in the compact disc formats. Inspired by Iranian cinema, home cinemas were intricately linked with the Islamic ethics of seeing and visuals. Can you share your thoughts on why the migrants insisted on having people back home watch this?
Just to clarify to the listeners, now, by home cinema, we do not mean those, you know, home videos where you have birthday parties and kids running around and stuff. Basically, this was a movement. Essentially a movement which had a very different distribution system because it was made outside the film industry. So these films, even though they were certified by the Central Board of Certification, they did not release in theaters. Instead, it had a very video shop-based distribution system. So this was a new system, like, you know, which this guy, Salam Kodiyadro, who was actually a school teacher, who is a school teacher, so not a professional filmmaker, but basically he was behind the idea. And this is what we mean by home cinema in this particular context. Now, if you look at this, these people who made these films, essentially they were an amateur theater group. And they wanted to, in the early 2000s, because there was a shift in technology, now we have CDs. It's like, you know, those VHS, we see those cassettes have given way to CDs. Things have become much easier, especially copying. Like, you know, you can copy several copies at the same time. And this is a very important technological shift. And they wanted to make use of this technological shift, all this digital turn, cheap cameras, all of that, to make cinema. Now, the milieu of these films was this Muslim life world in Malabar, the region of Kerala, basically North Kerala. And if you look at the Gulf phenomena, this is the region where, you know, most of the migrants come from. And Salam Kodiyadro, what he wanted to do, he wanted to capture this milieu. And he did something which was very unbelievable at the time. Because, you know, I mean, this is early 2000s. So far, only 3 or 4 Malayalam cinema has ever shown the Gulf so far. At that point of time, he shoots his film in Kuwait. I mean, his first Gulf film was shot in Kuwait. After that, he has shot in other places too. And this was a big deal. And what he did was that he asked many of these actual migrants who are working in the Gulf to act in his films. So, you know, many of his films are shot, I mean, a lot of scenes are shot in the night because that is the only time in which these migrants would be, you know, free. So only some 2 or 3 actors would go from here, and rest, all of the crew, cast and crew, it's basically from the Gulf. So this also made a personal connection. And what he did was also to introduce, I mean, basically to imitate the Iranian cinema, essentially a way of introducing an Islamic code of visuality. Now, what this did was that it made film watching justifiable to a lot of people, in because, you know, the discourse in early 2000s was that, I mean, it's a long discourse, was that, you know, this film is, cinema is not really Islamic. And what Salam Kodiyadro did was to introduce a new code in which, you know, finally you can enjoy cinema. But, you know, it's Islamic cinema.
Coming to the literary side of the study, literature on the Gulf migrant experiences, especially those written in the early 2000s, is engaged in detail in this book. It shows multiple experiences of migration, like getting stranded in horrible work circumstances in the desert, issues of environmentalism, racial and ethnic disparities at white-collar jobs, and so on. One thing that is striking is how carefully you detail the use of black boxes in Deepak Unnikrishnan's Temporary People. Can you elaborate on the affective relationship between words and migration based on these black boxes in Temporary People?
Deepak Unnikrishnan's work, Temporary People, so now it has got a Malayalam translation, by the way. It's translated by Benjamin, and it has, you know, all those illustrations by Apupan. So it's actually quite a departure from existing trend, at least if you look at Malayalam literature. Now, of course, there is the fact that Deepak Unnikrishnan originally wrote in English, and it is meant for a global audience. But at the same time, this is a work which has sights and sounds of Kerala in it. You know, and a lot of it is about migrants from Kerala, and a lot of it is actually a polyphony of Malayalam with English and Arabic. Right. Now, if you look at there's a usual pattern of writing about migrants in the Gulf, and this pattern was set by Babu Bharadwaj in the late 90s, which is that you take a migrant, you look at his life, you look at the conditions in which he had to leave home, you look at the conditions in which he is living in the Gulf, and usually it also ends up as some kind of tragedy. Like, you know, I mean, it's like this guy does not have anyone else anymore. That kind of, like, you know, usually it has a sad note to it. Now, this profiling is so prominent that almost all the works about Gulf migrants in the Kerala context follow this trend. Like, you know, you take up an individual and look at his life, his or her life. Okay. Now, if you look at Temporary People, it has migrants flitting in and out. You know, because it's a collection of, it's a novel, but it's also a collection of loosely linked stories. But interestingly, it does not follow this biographical mode of writing about the migrants. You know, it does not have this Bildung Soman kind of writing in which you detail out one person. It has migrants coming in and out without much of a background to it. It does not give you that mastery over the life of the migrant that, you know, the reader can judge the migrant, that kind of stuff. So that is, basically, there's a lot of, you know, basically, in Deepak Unnikrishnan's work, there is an increased acute awareness that, you know, this Gulf is built by the migrant, but it does not turn that into some kind of sympathy for the migrant, that kind of stuff. Now, the next big thing in Deepak's work is that it has basically departed from realism, and it basically works with irrealism. Now, why is this important? This is important because even when earlier works, when they wrote about migration, they would always speak about the fantasy land of that people have imagined about the Gulf. But they would make it very clear that their own work is very realist, is very ethnographic, you know. It's like you are making a study of other people. Now, what Deepak Unnikrishnan does is that he allows this fantasy to influence the form of his work. So, you know, it's basically, there is that strangeness of this migrant world. It's all kinds of languages, all kinds of different figures, this, that. And so it's like he does not keep the work realist to speak about the irrealism. His work in itself is irrealist. Now, to come to the black boxes that you pointed out in the question. Now, it's a very clever thing in Temporary People, because what it does is to mix the world of the migrant, which is the Gulf, and with the fictional world, which is there in this world. Because essentially, what does it stand for? It stands for censorship. But this censorship is where the private knowledge and the public knowledge, they come into clash with each other. Which is that even though there is censorship in public, things are known in private. You understand? It's basically a dramatization of what I'm trying to say in the entire book, which is that the fantasy of the Gulf is so strong in Kerala, because even when you speak about the Gulf in public, there's another layer of private knowledge that lingers behind that public knowledge. So basically, you know, the knowledge about the Gulf, even when it exists publicly, there is another knowledge of the Gulf, which is almost like a cultic password, you know. And Temporary People basically stages these clashes between the different registers of speaking about the Gulf. So I think it was a very clever way of doing it through the black box.
This is really an intriguing response. I would like to end our conversation with a gendered perspective on migration that you bring in. The subject of left behind wife is often a character of Grapevine in Kerala in the 20th century. What is their condition now? Have they been able to transcend the social stigma of living alone without husbands?
The left behind wives are actually not living alone because, you know, because of the patriarchal system in marriages in our place. They are living with basically their mother-in-laws, sister-in-laws and things. People of the husband's family. Now, there will be many houses in which all men of working ages have migrated. And basically, the elderly, the women and the children were left behind. So, because it is so common, it's not a stigma. However, the left behind wives are always subject to interested, you know, surveillance, gaze from all around. Because their husbands are away. And, you know, I mean, they're away. And they would be imagined to be unguarded and sexually unsatisfied. So basically, these are women who are imagined to be both on the lookout for possible pleasures, but also as a target of other people's, interested gaze. So, you know, it puts them in a very peculiar, I mean, they become this object of fascination and, you know, object of suspicion, all of that. Of course, today there is a better mobility for a larger section of migrants. You know, I mean, things have improved. Technology and, you know, travel, all of that has improved. But even so, there's quite a lot of substantial number of women who cannot go and stay with their families in the Gulf. And, you know, many of these letters, literature, all of them have this figure. And there's a lot of anxiety built around this figure of the left behind. Right. Today, it's not, of course, the same, but it is there. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Shafiq Karimkurigil, for joining the New Books Network. I'll be back with another new book. Stay tuned.